Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guest today is University of Washington endocrinologist, Dr. Alan Fehler. We'll be discussing thyroid disease, and of course, we'll be addressing your questions. Dr. Fehler is clinical associate professor of medicine at the University of Washington in the Division of Metabolism, Endocrinology, and Nutrition. If you have questions or comments about today's program in Anchorage, you can reach us at our local number, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1. You're going to have to spell it out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1 at kska.org. Dr. Fehler, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start off with some basic facts about the thyroid gland. I'd like, if you don't mind, trying to, without pictures, describe where that gland is, what it does, how it's activated, what does it produce, and symptoms of disease, for example.
The thyroid gland sits at the base of the neck in the front, or the anterior portion of the neck, right in the front, kind of just below the Adam's apple. It is a butterfly-shaped gland where there's the connecting piece in the middle that's just below the Adam's apple, or the larynx, is called the isthmus, and then on either side there are two lobes, the right and left lobe. It is a gland that is run by the pituitary gland, as many end-organ hormonal-producing glands are. And the pituitary gland senses what thyroid levels are, the thyroid hormone levels are, and as a result makes a hormone that you'll hear more about as we go along called thyroid-stimulating hormone that is a small peptide or protein that then stimulates the thyroid to make more thyroid hormone. And usually this is a very delicately balanced feedback mechanism where it keeps your thyroid levels very stable. Thyroid hormone is kind of, I guess the easiest way to explain is it's kind of the carburetor of your body. All tissues in the body use thyroid hormone, have the capability to take up and use thyroid hormone. And so its effects are wide-ranging because of the fact that all tissues are dependent upon it.
We think of thyroid hormone, and I know people who are listening may be aware of tests, and we often will say T4, and then sometimes we hear the word T3, and you've mentioned thyroid-stimulating hormone. Sometimes people may know what thyroid-releasing hormone is. Should we define those a little bit, too?
Sure. T4 is the primary hormone that is produced by the thyroid gland and then circulates in the bloodstream, and it is about 85% of the thyroid hormone that is produced by the thyroid gland and secreted in the bloodstream is T4. It is referred to as what's called a prohormone. So that means it circulates as in the reservoir of the bloodstream, attached mostly to a protein, and then the tissues can take up the T4 at variable rates, which they clearly do. All tissues don't take up T4 at the same rate. And the tissues actually convert the T4 into T3, which is then the active hormone at the level of the nucleus or the cell itself. Once it's inside the cell, it's T3 that is the active hormone. TSH, as I mentioned too, is thyroid-stimulating hormone that's made in the pituitary. It's actually regulated via the hypothalamus, which kind of sits just above the pituitary, and the hypothalamus makes TRH, or thyrotropin-releasing hormone, that, based upon a number of inputs, then regulates TSH secretion.
So when you say that there's like feedback mechanisms with hormones, we're talking about when, let's say, the T4 goes down, then there's a compensatory change in thyroid-stimulating hormone to go up to try to get the thyroid gland to make more T4 and
right.
Vice versa. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely, and that's oftentimes kind of an area of confusion. People see an elevated TSH, and they think that means that their thyroid is high, which actually it means that the pituitary is convinced that thyroid levels are low. Mm-hmm. And unless there's some reason to be concerned about your pituitary function, it's usually the best final arbiter of what your thyroid level should be.
Okay. All right. And my understanding is that T4 and TSH, using those two together, are the key tests to establish how your thyroid gland is doing. Is that fair to say?
That's true. And usually, I think what's for a long time been recommended is TSH as the best single test as a screen for thyroid function.
Okay.
And you could make the argument that might miss pituitary dysfunction. It might, but thyroid dysfunction is very common. Pituitary dysfunction is very uncommon to rare. So if there is an issue with the thyroid, you'll, you know, 95%+ of the time you would find it with the TSH.
Is there an easy way to describe the purpose of the thyroid gland? You said it's extremely important, or it must be important evolutionarily if we've all our cells, all our glands, everything has receptors for this, then it's extremely important. What are the primary purposes or functions then of the thyroid hormone?
Well, it's important and actually necessary for normal growth and development. So there are anyone that's had thyroid issues and has been pregnant knows that people pay a lot more attention to their thyroid levels during pregnancy, part because pregnancy can change things, but the normal development of a fetus or baby is very dependent upon having normal thyroid levels. So normal growth and development is very dependent upon thyroid levels, but it's kind of sets the metabolic rate. So people that are hypothyroid, everything kind of slows down. People that are hyperthyroid, everything speeds up.
Okay. We've talked about the specific chemicals that are measured to assess the thyroid gland. Before we start talking about individual diseases, what other diagnostic tests may our listeners may have run into that might be important for us to mention?
Well, there's what we've talked about so far are functional aspects of the pituitary, which have to do with the thyroid hormone production. More and more people maybe are aware of thyroid nodules, which the blood levels only very occasionally are abnormal in people that have thyroid nodules. Thyroid nodules are seemingly getting in more and more play, and people are more and more aware of them since they're fairly common and picked up oftentimes when people are doing imaging studies for other reasons. But thyroid nodules and ultrasounds, which are the best way of assessing thyroid nodules, is something else that people ought to be aware of.
Okay. Well, let's talk about hyperthyroidism and hypothyroidism. One would mean there's too much thyroid hormone is how I interpreted. Hypo is too little. So let's talk about what those are, what kind of symptoms we have, what are the causes?
Hyperthyroidism is probably is much less common than hypothyroidism, but it's still a relatively common disorder. And although and the most common cause of hyperthyroidism is something called Graves' disease, was named after a man named Daniel Graves, which is where that term comes from. It's actually sounds fairly exotic. It's an autoimmune disease where your own immune system has made an antibody that reacts with your thyroid. In this case, it's the only autoantibody that is not destructive in nature and actually stimulates the thyroid to make more thyroid hormone. So although people frequently refer to Graves' disease as a thyroid disorder, that's somewhat of a misnomer. The disorder is actually in your immune system. The thyroid is kind of an innocent bystander that is overstimulated as a result of this immunologic disorder. But despite the fact, as I say, that it sounds relatively exotic, it's actually reasonably common. It's about 6 times more common in women than in men. And although it occurs at all ages, the peak incidence is between the age of 20 and 40. Other causes of hyperthyroidism include multinodular goiters, which are the second most common, or so-called hot nodules. And then there's a handful of relatively rare causes. People that have hyperthyroidism, the most common symptoms are palpitations, feeling your heart pound rapidly or irregularly, tremors, your hands shaking, unexplained weight loss, difficulty sleeping, feeling more anxious, nervous than seems reasonable for the given situation, more frequent and looser bowel movements, sweating more, feeling hot all the time. Those are the typical symptoms of hyperthyroidism.
Can they also be somewhat subtle, or is it usually pretty obvious when someone is suffering from hyperthyroidism?
Well, it can be. There's all sorts of, you know, it's a spectrum. So there are people that have very borderline hyperthyroidism, a category that's oftentimes referred to as subclinical hyperthyroidism. So the numbers actually fall into the hyperthyroid category, although people with that term subclinical hyperthyroidism, most of them don't have any symptoms or any symptoms that you can clearly attribute to their thyroid.
Mm-hmm. And a person with hyperthyroidism would have a higher T4, which then feeds back and causes the TSH to be low.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, let's talk about hypothyroidism.
Hypothyroidism is the reverse. It's low thyroid hormone levels, and as I mentioned, things tend to slow down. So constipation, lethargy, fatigue, unexplained weight gain, change in menstrual periods in women, increased dryness and coarseness of the skin and hair and fingernails are all symptoms. Most causes of hypothyroidism occur very insidiously over a period of time, so it's not like you're fine one day and the next day you wake up and you know you must be hypothyroid. It usually occurs over a relatively long period of time. I'll also point out that those symptoms are also relatively nonspecific, so although you have to have an index of suspicion for considering hypothyroidism, most people that can identify with one or more of those symptoms don't actually have hypothyroidism, particularly the one about the unexplained weight gain. Endocrinologists see people all the time that is the primary reason for being their reasons why they think they may be hypothyroid, and although they might be, most of the people, if that's their primary reason and their only primary symptom, that's not very likely they have hypothyroidism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The causes of hypothyroidism?
The most common is something called Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which again is an autoimmune disorder. And most autoimmune disorders are very uncommon to rare. For reasons that aren't perfectly understood, the ones that affect the thyroid gland are actually fairly common. So Hashimoto's thyroiditis is probably 6 to 10 times more common than like Graves' disease, and is a relatively common disorder where the antibodies in this case are actually destructive to the thyroid. And usually that's a very slow, gradual destruction of the thyroid that occurs literally over years. Other causes, there are so-called, there's a number of inborn errors or congenital causes of people that don't make thyroid hormone as efficiently as they may be because there's a number of enzymes that they may have a somewhat less active form of that can lead to difficulties in making thyroid hormone, and that can cause hypothyroidism also. Some people that have multinodular goiters, I mentioned that is a cause of hyperthyroidism. It's also a cause of hypothyroidism in certain individuals.
Okay. I've got a couple of emails, and they all relate to either Hashimoto's or Graves. So I'm going to go ahead and take those. The first one relates to Graves' disease. This is a lady who says, I've got Graves' ophthalmopathy. I was told that there is no good treatment for it, and it will either get worse or go away. Do you know this condition, how this condition develops, and is there any treatment for it?
Well, let me take the how it develops. As I mentioned, Graves' disease is an immunologic disorder in which your immune system somehow has made a mistake and recognized something that belongs to you as deserving of attack. There's actually a lot of controversy amongst endocrinologists about whether the antibodies that stimulate this response that cause the bulging of the eyes or the Graves' ophthalmopathy, whether they are the same antibodies that cause the overactivity of the thyroid gland or whether they're related but not exactly the same. And that's probably more just of academic interest, but it does occur in a proportion of a certain percentage of people that have Graves' disease that they also get an inflammation behind their eyes. So it's not the eye itself, but the tissues behind the eye. And the inflammation there causes swelling, and the swelling pushes the eyes forward. So you've heard people that have these prominent or eyes that are characteristic of Graves' ophthalmopathy, and it's because these tissues behind the inflammation pushes the eye forward. What percentage of people with Graves' disease have this manifestation kind of depends on how you define it. So people that have clinically significant, that an uninformed person otherwise would notice there's something wrong with the eyes, it's probably only about 10%. But if you talk about people that would have some evidence of swelling in the tissues behind their eyes, if you did sensitive scans in them, it's probably 70 to 80%. So it depends on kind of how you define the situation as to what percentage of people have this. The treatments, I would agree with the statement, there's no good treatment. It either gets better or worse in most people. There are the use of corticosteroids will oftentimes treat the symptoms fairly well. The problem is whether the benefit for the ophthalmopathy is worth all the problems that are caused by the corticosteroids. So these medications have a high morbidity when used over the longer term, and yes, they will. They work in most people with Graves' ophthalmopathy to decrease the inflammation, but they do so at some fairly significant morbidity from the medication itself. So we tend to be relatively judicious in who we use them to. Yeah. There's usually this active inflammatory stage. Eventually, that gets better. The inflammation gets better, and sometimes there's enough fibrous tissue or scar tissue from the inflammation that the eyes don't get better at that point, but there are very good techniques for surgically ameliorating the situation with the eyes once the inflammatory stage has abated.
Perhaps it would be useful to ask the question, what's the natural history of Graves' disease? And what I'm getting at for this person who's emailing is, you know, what happens to most people with Graves' disease? Does it spontaneously stop? Is it hard to predict? And then what happens to the eye symptoms once, you know, one of those courses takes a turn?
The natural history is that it doesn't tend to just generally just go away spontaneously, or if you just hang in there long enough, it will go away. That doesn't oftentimes happen. People do talk about, quote, burned out, end quote, Graves' disease, which actually that's probably a little bit misleading to talk about that. So some people that have hyperthyroidism over the long term, eventually they become hypothyroid. And that's really not specifically what they say, that the Graves' disease burns out, at least how that what that connotes. It's usually the fact that if you have autoimmune eye disease, you may have both sets of antibodies, both those that are stimulatory and those that are destructive. And early on, when it first begins, your thyroid is mostly intact and fine, and so you become hyperthyroid. But over the long term, the destructive antibodies very slowly decrease the amount of functional thyroid tissue, and eventually you can't be hyperthyroid because there isn't enough functional thyroid tissue to generate that much thyroid hormone, and people eventually become hypothyroid. There really isn't very good data to say which percentage of people that would happen if you just held in there, because unfortunately what happens with most people is they just get gradually worse over months to years and kind of forces the hand in terms of treating them.
Okay. All right. I have an email relating to Hashimoto's, just to remind everyone that's an inflammatory disorder. It usually ends up with low thyroid function. And Wendy emails, it says, because it's very hard, even with needle biopsy, to determine if a person has Hashimoto's, and because cancer is so rare in the thyroid, what point is there to undergoing surgery if the TSH level is normal, yet there's only a swollen thyroid gland to indicate problems?
I think there's a number of issues there. One, if the TSH is normal, then the assumption would be that the thyroid hormone production is normal, and that really doesn't mean the thyroid will be enlarged, normal in size or even small. That's not inconsistent. And so you wouldn't do anything necessarily to correct the thyroid hormone levels. We very rarely do biopsies to document Hashimoto's disease, and it's usually fairly simple to determine that by measuring the antibody levels to show that it's consistent with it. And in truth, decide whether you're hypothyroid from that or other reasons is also more academic than it is important to know exactly whether it's you have a congenital disorder of thyroid hormone production or you have Hashimoto's is probably just more of academic interest. Thyroid cancer is not rare. It's not real common, but it's certainly not rare. It's actually one of the few cancers that the incidence is increasing. Many people believe, and I think most of the evidence would suggest at least most of the increase we're seeing is because of the fact that we're much better at diagnosing it than we used to be. Although, does that explain the whole thing? We don't really know that. And so there may be environmental things that we aren't aware of that more and more people are being exposed to that explains the increase in incidence.
Let's look at, if you don't mind, Wendy's question a little bit more and wonder if maybe there's some misunderstanding. What we know is that she's got a TSH level she thinks is normal, but her thyroid gland is swollen, she says. What would that make you think of with just those two facts?
Well, the fact that it's swollen, I would interpret as meaning that it's enlarged. The term goiter just means thyroid gland enlargement. There are different subtypes of goiter, so just knowing it's enlarged would say that by definition she has a goiter, but it doesn't tell us why she has a goiter, and there's lots of different reasons. Whether the fact there's an enlargement, a diffuse enlargement where the whole gland is enlarged, actually makes thyroid cancer relatively unlikely. Thyroid cancer, if it was to occur, would usually start as a nodule and would be a focal area of enlargement, not the whole thing, in general, is what you'd expect. So she raised the question of cancer, and at least she doesn't describe anything that would make me think of cancer in her situation. She may just have a simple goiter. If she's describing a goiter, what kind of goiter, I don't have enough information to say.
Okay. But her question got to undergoing surgery. Would surgery be a, how am I going to ask this question, a relatively common approach, or would more testing be an appropriate situation, most likely, given what you know?
If there was some concern about thyroid cancer, then surgery might be appropriate.
Okay.
If the gland was large enough that it was putting, that was either a cosmetic or functional concern, in other words, it was putting pressure on the trachea or the esophagus, so people are having trouble breathing or swallowing, and we do see people with glands that large, then that would be a reason to consider surgery, but just because it's enlarged is not a reason that we would consider surgery.
Okay. All right. Well, I was just trying to perhaps give Wendy a little bit more information from what we had, and it wasn't enough to be exactly sure. We do have a phone call as well. This is a question, looks like, about TSH. Diane, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I have two questions. One is, which you can answer second if you want, is talk about subclinical thyroidism, hypothyroidism, hair falling out, people who are cold, even given our climate all the time, and I know it's really a tough thing. My main question is how to keep the TSH levels within a narrow range. My doctor says I have Hashimoto's and had half of my thyroid out and then went on Synthroid a few months later just because even though the TSH was normal, the other half was enlarging, and that may have been a mistake to go on Synthroid. But the point is, one doctor says, oh, I can't possibly know when I'm within normal range but on either end of the TSH. Well, I think I can. I have had a really hard time keeping it around, I think, 2 is what my primary care doctor says to keep it at. I was poorly educated as to the need to stay away from iron and calcium for 4 hours after taking Synthroid, and finally, in desperation, we had our water tested. We have a well, and it is it was very high in calcium and iron, at least some parts at times of the year. So we filtered our water, and I've had more luck now being very careful with that, plus the iron and the calcium. But still, occasionally it'll sneak up on me, and I'd end up off the scale in the hyperthyroid range for no apparent reason. So what's the magic way to keep this, you know, right at 2 and maybe even lose some weight, which never went away?
The weight thing, I wish I could tell you that the thyroid is the answer to that. And in some respects, that's kind of the bane of the endocrinologist's existence, is because, yes, the thyroid has some something to do with weight regulation. But it's, unless you're at one end of the spectrum or the other, it rarely has marked effects upon weight one way or the other. So oftentimes people are disappointed if they think that normalizing their thyroid is going to just take care of any weight issues.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
Yeah. In terms of what you said about where you can, I will tell you the conventional wisdom is that people can't tell whether it's normal, high normal, low normal, or we're in the range, and that a lot of the conventional wisdom would be if you're mildly abnormal one way or the other, most people can't tell the difference. And I think it's fair that most people can't, although I've done this long enough now that I have a number of patients that convinced me over the years that they know where their levels are and they can tell the difference between even mid-range normal and high normal or low normal, because they've told me before we've checked them where it is, and they've convinced me over the years they do know. So the conventional wisdom, and I think it's fair to say most people can't tell, there clearly are individuals, and you may very well be one of those, they can tell within those range. At least that's my opinion. As they say, that's not what the conventional wisdom would be. There are a number of things. It's kind of a finicky, thyroid hormone is kind of finicky in terms of how it's absorbed. So it's important you take it on an empty stomach. Calcium, aspirin, and iron are all things that specifically interfere with thyroid hormone absorption. But even just food does. And actually, there's enough calcium, like in milk, that if you take it with milk, that will cause trouble. And it sounds like the trouble, the calcium in your well may be causing problems.
Well,
so you might, instead of taking it with water, you know, take it with fruit juice or something there. Maybe you can stay away. Fruit juice is not enough food quantity in there that you'd have an issue, and you should wait about an hour before eating anything else.
No, we filter our water now, so that's not...
Okay, so that's good enough.
Yeah, so that's
usually in most people that is takes care of it. There are other people when we see that their thyroid levels bounce around and we're pretty sure they're taking it in the prescribed manner, we then consider possibilities that there's other things going on that are affecting the absorption. So there's, you know, Hashimoto's is an autoimmune disease. There's something called celiac disease that has a huge spectrum, and some people have obvious symptoms, other people do not. That's also thought to be an autoimmune disorder, and so sometimes that can cause problems with thyroid hormone absorption, even if people are taking it in the correct manner. So that's something we screen for in people that we have trouble keeping their levels stable, and we think the people are taking it in the appropriate manner. But most people, if they're taking it right, it does go, it smooths out and it's fairly simple. But there is a small group of people that it's a constant headache for them and for us.
Okay. And my first question, I can take off the air unless you need more.
Oh, the subclinical.
Yeah.
A subclinical hypothyroidism it sounds like it's a clinical definition, but it's actually a biochemical definition, and it's a definition where the T4 and the T3 levels are normal, but the TSH is modestly elevated, and it's said that 80% of those people are asymptomatic. Well, it's kind of hard to know for sure, because, you know, how many people can you talk to that won't say they have a little bit of fatigue or constipation, or maybe their skin's a little dry, they've been losing more hair than usual. Almost everyone can answer yes to at least one of those things. So people that you can verifiably say are not symptomatic at all, I'm not so sure it's so easy to do with that. But as I say, the biochemical definition, which is the definition of subclinical hypothyroidism, is modestly elevated TSH with normal T4 and T3 levels.
Okay. And no other suggestions on that, how to deal with it?
Well, if you've just recently got the filter and everything, that should be good. If you're still having trouble with your levels bouncing around, I would suggest being screened for celiac disease.
That last question was for some friends of mine who were told they were subclinical or whose doctors won't believe that they maybe are. So that wasn't for me, but thanks.
Sure. I'll tell you that about 50% of people that meet those criteria for subclinical hypothyroidism can do nothing. Within 6 to 12 months, their levels are perfectly normal. So that's one of the reasons why a lot of people would say, rather than start them on thyroid hormone and presumably commit them for life, why if people aren't clearly symptomatic, it might be best to just wait and see if it doesn't take care of itself.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for your call. We need to take a short break. I want to remind you, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433, the toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@kska.org. After this short break, we'll continue to take your calls and emails and talk with Dr. Alan Fehler of the University of Washington. On Line 1, your health connection, I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is the University of Washington endocrinologist and, by definition, I guess, thyroid specialist, Dr. Alan Fehler. Now, you can email your questions and comments to line1@kska.org, and you can call us directly at 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, if you're listening to Line 1 between 8 and 9 p.m. local time, then you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we won't be available to take your phone calls. We've suddenly got a lot of phone calls, Dr. Fehler, and a couple of emails, okay. So let's see what we can get through. Here's an email. It says, how often have you found that having half of the thyroid out because of Hashimoto's causes the other half of what was previously a normal thyroid gland to crash, thus causing the person to have to go on to Synthroid? And then the second question is, how long should a person wait until going on to Synthroid just because the remaining half has become enlarged?
Well, I think I'd ask you to take a little different look at what Hashimoto's is to answer the first question. Hashimoto's is a low-grade inflammation of the entire thyroid gland. And though sometimes it may be a little asymmetric to begin with, usually the whole thyroid is involved. And I'm pretty sure that it's never been described where there would be someone that had clear Hashimoto's in half the thyroid and no evidence of it in the other one.
Okay.
So up to a certain point, you make enough thyroid hormone by your entire thyroid gland kind of contributing. And most endocrine organs, there's the so-called 10% rule, which means if you have 10% of a normal gland, you can usually meet your needs, and there's a lot of backup or reserve in the other 90%. So as long as if you're getting along fine, but you take out half of a gland that's just barely meeting your needs, then you're not going to meet your needs with the remaining half because you were just barely making it with the whole. And I think that's what happens if you have Hashimoto's. You take out half the gland, you may not have needed to be on thyroid hormone to begin with, but you're almost certainly going to be then if you're very far down the path. If you have if the remaining gland, half a gland, is really normal, then you would not need to be on thyroid hormone.
Okay. All right, here's another email from a woman named Sandy. She says she's got a 32-year-old daughter, has had her antibodies tested, which came back positive. According to her physician, the interpretation was this is a low-level reading. Her low-level reading of antibodies is an indicator of Graves' disease. Her father had Graves' disease, by the way. She's also had three series of tests on her thyroid gland, which come back somewhat different. Evidently, the numbers are bouncing around. Her physician wishes to put her on, the patient on Tapazole to control this condition, T-A-P-A-Z-O-L, or I think it's T-A-P-I-Z-O-L, actually. Can you tell me if this drug will indeed be helpful in treating or postponing Graves' disease, and she's concerned about side effects such as liver disease or liver damage?
It's Tapazole, T-A-P-A-Z-O-L-E.
Okay.
And that's the most common trade name for a drug. The generic name is methimazole. And it's one of two medications in this country that will slow thyroid functions, slow thyroids down that are overactive. There is no evidence that it would prevent the development of Graves' disease. And so I would say that if they're not really hyperthyroid, that there's no indication for using the medication at this point in time. Although some people that take this medication, there is some evidence it will induce remissions. There's no evidence that if you take someone that they think isn't hyperthyroid but may be headed in that direction, that it will prevent that from occurring. So I think that if indeed they're not hyperthyroid, I would tell you that there's no evidence that will keep them from becoming hyperthyroid. There's really no evidence there's anything that would do that. There's probably some very powerful immune-regulating drugs that might do that, but they have enough problems in and of themselves that I don't know that anyone would recommend that you use them for that purpose. So, one, I wouldn't use Tapazole if they're not already hyperthyroid. That is a reasonable option if they are hyperthyroid. Was there more to the question than that?
Let me move back. We're getting phone calls or emails by the gazillions here. I think that was it. Yeah, worried about side effects, which you've addressed.
Oh, the side effects, the liver function abnormalities or hepatitis and inflammation of the liver or a very low white blood cell count are the only serious complications. They're relatively rare, but are very serious when they occur. They're like 1 in 10 to 25,000 people.
I usually try to bring up the issue of understanding that there's a risk to not doing a treatment versus the risk of doing the treatment, so that you need to be aware that it's not a risk-free option when making these decisions.
Yeah.
Okie doke. Another email. During the early 50s, I think this is an important question, a little different than what we've been asking about or talking about, however, but I think it's interesting. During the early 1950s, there was a practice of X-raying infants' thyroid gland, which was common in the hospital where this person was born. I was diagnosed as being hypothyroid at age 17. I recently read an article noting that this practice often causes breast cancer in women during the 30s. At age 58, I'm fortunately cancer-free. Do you have any advice or information for myself or other women in the same situation?
Well, if they're talking about radiation therapy, at one time in the 40s and early 50s, they used to use radiation therapy for a lot of things that aren't done anymore, including enlarged thymus glands, which in young people can be normal, enlarged thyroids, enlarged tonsils for acne, for a variety of things. The hotbed of that was actually the Midwest, centered kind of in Chicago, but it was practiced to a lesser degree in lots of places during that time frame. And those things, that radiation exposure has been known to induce other cancers. Now, the stuff that's done around the neck and catches the thyroid gland, like for the tonsils and the thymus and things, has been shown to increase the risk of thyroid cancer as well as increased risk of hypothyroidism. People that have that known radiation treatment risk, we recommend that they have intermittent ultrasounds and anything that's suspicious, do biopsy. So usually we do a baseline. If there's nothing suspicious, there's nothing there at all, we'd probably wait 2 years to repeat it. And after two or three of them, if nothing comes up at this point, you'd wait. But usually the thyroid cancers that occur with that kind of exposure take 20 years or so before they manifest themselves.
She mentions an increased risk of breast cancer in this. Is that an issue, or is it mainly thyroid cancer that we're aware of?
Well, at least I won't claim any expertise, and I don't know why they'd be catching the breasts in the field that right. would be used right. for these other things, so I don't know of any increased risk for that. But for the things that the thyroid being caught in the radiation field, there is an increased risk of thyroid cancer.
And we want to make sure we understand the difference between just a normal X-ray and radiation therapy, and we're
right.
assuming that the questioner, the person writing, means the radiation therapy, much higher
right.
doses.
Yeah.
Okay. Another phone call. Sue, you're on line one.
Hello.
Yep. What can we do for you?
I am 65 years old. I have been taking Synthroid probably for 15 years. In a routine physical, the doctor said I needed to take it, so I did. As far as I can tell, I had no symptoms, and I could tell no difference from before or after I started taking the meds. Is that normal? Should I just stop taking them and have another test, or should I just keep taking it for the rest of my life?
You could stop taking them and get your thyroid levels rechecked. As I mentioned, if your levels were only mildly abnormal, and let's say that you had subclinical hypothyroidism when they checked, there was a 50% chance that would go back to normal on its own. I obviously don't know what the levels were at that point. But
Nor do I.
And people have a great deal of, there's a big spectrum in terms of how sensitive they are to, in terms of symptoms related to these levels. So I've seen people with borderline levels that are clearly symptomatic and clearly get better with treatment. I've also seen people with markedly abnormal values that really have very little to almost no response to treatment in terms of change. They felt fine before, and they don't feel any better by making their levels normal. So I will tell you that there is at least one documented risk. If you could tell me that your levels were abnormal, but you felt no better with making them normal, there is evidence that untreated hypothyroidism carries with an increased risk of cardiovascular disease or heart attacks and strokes. And that's been documented in several studies. I wonder whether you really have needed to be on thyroid hormone all this time. And if your thyroid gland is basically normal, it will pick up activity again if you stop taking the thyroid hormone.
Is there any downside other than the cost of continuing on Synthroid forever?
Not if your levels are normal. We don't know of any downside. If you're taking too much, there are some downsides. But if your levels are normal, we don't know of any downsides other than the cost and inconvenience.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
All right, let's take another phone call. Roy, you're on line one. Hello, Roy. All right, let's. There's another email that I think is bringing up a slightly different issue. It's by a psychiatrist in Alaska, and he has written and wants to know a little bit about mood disorders and thyroid disease, and he'd ask you to discuss the interface between thyroid disorders and, let's say, true bipolar disorder or major depression. In particular, is there evidence that there's more thyroid disease relative to individuals without these disorders? And then what is the evidence for thyroid augmentation in the treatment of these disorders?
Well, the evidence, one, I don't think there's any convincing evidence that that thyroid disorders are more common in people who have major affective disorders, depression, etc., bipolar disorder. Acute exacerbations of psychiatric disorders, people that have major depression, that are in a manic phase of bipolar disorder, those people can have a variant of what's called the euthyroid 6 syndrome that can make their thyroid transiently, the levels abnormal, that is a result of them being more acutely ill, but doesn't necessarily imply they have underlying long-term thyroid disease. Certainly, thyroid function does affect mood. I think that people that are hyperthyroid could, by the some in some cases, might appear to be manic, and so there might be some overlap, although certainly the history and the thyroid level should tell you the difference between the two. The issue about the use of thyroid hormone and augmentation of treatment of depression is something that comes up fairly frequently. There actually is no data in the endocrinologic literature, and so all the stuff that's published regarding that, and I've gone back and reviewed that because it comes up fairly regularly, all that data is in the psychiatric literature. And I certainly understand the reasons why psychiatric endpoints are somewhat soft. I mean, there's only so much manipulation you can do, and the endpoints by nature are all going to be soft or fairly subjective. Endocrinologists frequently kind of scoff at those endpoints as not being very convincing. So I know that I have a number of friends and psychiatrists that use thyroid hormone and augmentative therapy, and they're convinced it works, and I have no problems with that. I do think that if you use it at excessive doses, which is what it ends up being, at least I've seen that many times where the doses cause their thyroid levels to be actually hyperthyroid with the suppression of their TSH, there are some long-term consequences and risks to doing that. So like lots of things in medicine, you have to weigh the benefits versus the potential downside. So it kind of depends on what other history someone has. Someone has a history of atrial fibrillation or heart problems. You know, to do that may be a lot more risky than doing an otherwise healthy young person.
Okay. Let's take another caller. Robin, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Yeah, I've got a couple of questions. But first, I want to make a quick comment about that one lady that called about her fluctuating TSH, and you mentioned getting checked for celiac. I was diagnosed with celiac last summer, and just a warning for those on Synthroid, after you go off the gluten, that's the Synthroid really starts to absorb. I went really hyper, and I went down to 0.03, ended up in urgent care. So if you have celiac, keep an eye on this TSH. So just a warning out there. It wasn't fun. So in 2005, I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's, but I didn't live with it very long. They found out I had thyroid cancer. So I'm on Synthroid. But I have a question. I have a problem with estrogen dominance right now. And I heard there's some link between if you have high levels of estrogen and the cells not being able to uptake the thyroid medication as well. So even though you have fine levels, like my level is 1.15 now, I still kind of feel hypo. So is that true, that estrogen can interfere?
Well, sort of. I think the connotation, the way you describe it, I wouldn't agree with that. But estrogen does have an effect upon thyroid levels kind of indirectly. So someone that has a normal thyroid gland, normal thyroid will adapt to changes in estrogen levels without problems. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a normal thyroid gland, then that you may need changes in dose based upon what's going on with estrogen. So like a woman that starts on birth control pills, that may change their requirements, or if they go off birth control pills, or something that changes their estrogen level may change their dose requirement. And the reason for that is that estrogens affect what's called thyroid-binding globulin, which is the protein that most thyroid hormone is bound to as it circulates in the bloodstream. So if you increase the amount of thyroid binding globulin, you need more thyroid hormone to fill all those binding spaces. Otherwise, you affect the amount that is available to cells. Mm. So it's not the cells that they can't get it, or that they don't take it up normally. It's that it's not there. It's all bound up by the protein unless you increase the amount of the available hormone, because the amount that is free from the binding protein is in kind of an equilibrium. So you, as they say, a normal thyroid will just adjust to that no problems, but If you don't have that, you may need to adjust the dose based on those changes.
And hopefully if I get my estrogen dominance under control, that hopefully would help things.
That would help things, yes.
Now, I have a son with, he's 15, he has type 1 diabetes, and he was diagnosed with Hashimoto's, and he has nodules. We had an ultrasound. Now, what is the care with that? I mean, with me, I had high, you know, they kind of had Hashimoto's. They did an ultrasound. There are nodules. They biopsied those nodules. With him, they didn't bother to biopsy him, and the doctor said there's no need to ever do another ultrasound ever again. But, I mean, isn't that something to be watched?
I guess it depends on what they're describing. You know, they could be describing a bunch of little cysts that are 2 millimeters in size, and I would say those probably don't need any further attention. If they're true nodules and aren't just little cysts, if they're solid or whatever, then and just small, they may not need biopsies now. So it used to be that we used strictly size criteria for deciding about biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
People, and more recently, because of the frequency of thyroid nodules, have started moving towards using other criteria other just than size. And it's because we're learning a lot more and realizing just because there's a nodule there doesn't define its risk.
Mm-hmm.
And we're learning other things to help define whether it's what the risk is of that nodule being thyroid cancer. So the criteria for what you biopsy and what you aren't is changing. There are several ultrasound studies that show that if you just randomly select people off the street and do ultrasounds, you can find these little tiny nodules in up to 40 or 50% of people off the street. So just saying you have thyroid nodules doesn't help a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of making a decision about what you want to do about them.
I guess if it's something where they did an ultrasound later and then they changed, then they'd probably want to...
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
A change would be one of the criteria people would use for whether it needs more attention.
Okay. All right, well, thank you for your
sure.
answers.
Sure.
Thanks for your call, Robin. We have about 5 minutes left. I have more emails that I'm going to get to, so I want to remind Dr. Fehler we've got about 5 minutes and apologize for those who we don't get to their questions. Here's my first additional question, though. My neighbor takes something other than Synthroid for her hypothyroidism that was given to her by a naturopath. What are the pros and cons of this? I know we don't know what it is that you're taking or she's taking, but perhaps you could talk about experiences you've had with different kinds of medications for thyroid disease.
Synthroid is a trade name, and it's a form of T4. That is synthetically produced. There are lots of other synthetically produced forms of T4 that aren't the name brand Synthroid. And although it used to be that endocrinologists very commonly recommended Synthroid specifically, I don't, and many endocrinologists don't anymore. But what you should do is stay on one form of thyroid hormone because switching back and forth, the relative absorption, although each one by themselves are fairly consistent, they're not all exactly the same. So switching back and forth can lead to changes in your thyroid levels. I suspect that it's what's called desiccated thyroid that is the form that the naturopath has prescribed. And they do that based on the idea that it is more, quote, natural, end quote, since instead of being synthetically produced, it is ground-up pig and cow thyroids. It's not the fact they're pig and cow thyroids, but the thyroid gland, grinding it up and giving it to someone, does not give you the forms of thyroid hormone that are normally secreted into the bloodstream. The thyroid gland is something that is it's a gland that stores a lot of preformed hormone in something called colloid. And the colloid, when you just grind it up, doesn't give you the same forms of thyroid hormone that a normal thyroid will take out of storage, chemically alter a little bit, and then secrete into the bloodstream. So to say that's a natural way of getting your thyroid hormone and that what you get in terms of your blood levels is natural that way is really incorrect. But that is the argument that I've heard most frequently as to why to use that. The amount of thyroid hormone is not quantified in these preparations, and the preparations are quantified based on the iodine content, which can be very misleading in terms of the amount of active thyroid hormone. So I actually think they're not a very good product, but I have some patients that insist on taking them, and as long as their levels stay in the normal range, I don't insist they change.
Okay. We have a couple of minutes later. I want to give you an opportunity to maybe just talk about anything you'd like or make any comments about what you think might be important for us not to miss in the last couple of minutes, or I can go through one or two more questions, or at least one more question. But I wanted you to have a chance to say some things.
Well, I appreciate that. No, but one thing I'd mention is that people, a number of times for on my own entertainment, I have searched the web on the subjects of hypothyroidism and those things, and some of the things I come up with are pretty entertaining, but also somewhat horrifying to an endocrinologist. So my plea would be is to look with a discerning eye on the information you run across, because the thyroid seems to be a favorite thing that people have all sorts of claims about that are very poorly documented or supported. So I think you have to be a little bit of a discerning consumer and information about thyroid disorders and thyroid issues. And I guess that's the one plea I would make.
I would maybe go a little further in suggestion that we put a link to the Medline Plus, the National Institutes of Health site on thyroid disease, is a reliable source. I'd like your comments on that. And then also that it usually is helpful to go to one of the major universities, the Mayo Clinic, University of Washington, any of these, and look at what they have to say, particularly if you're looking at something that's not from one of the leading universities.
I think that's true. I think there's a lot of places. Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic are two places that come in mind that have really, I think, very user-friendly and well-designed patient information centers. The Hormone Foundation has a lot of patient education materials that is very helpful, I think, and very well-founded. All of those sources are good.
One maybe quick question again. Is there a difference between treatment with T3 versus T4?
Well, there is a difference. I'm not so sure I can give that a fair treatment in the time remaining, but there is a difference. I will say there's a lot of controversy over whether you should use combinations. I don't know of any good argument to use T3 exclusively outside of very specific situations, but combinations of T4 and T3 are pretty controversial. There's a lot more hype than there is substance to a lot of the discussions that go on surrounding that. There is a fairly good scientific literature that addresses that, which would suggest that T3 doesn't, at least in groups of people, doesn't offer a lot of additional benefit or any additional benefit.
Dr. Fehler, thanks very much for your experience and your recommendations. It's been a wonderful hour for our listeners.
Thank you very much.
Line 1 will return again next week, and we'll discuss environmental toxins and human health with Dr. David Carpenter. Dr. Carpenter is the director of the Institute for Health and the Environment at the University at Albany, State University of New York. Pat Yack is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. Josh Edge helped to man the phones, which he's been doing for quite a while without any recognition. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.